This is the Wheeler Centre podcast.
Hello and welcome to this special final Next Big Thing event, the Most Underrated Book Award. I'm Mel Cranenberg, host of Triple R's Backstory, a show about books, the craft of writing, and the people behind the lines. Before we begin this event, I'd like to acknowledge that we are meeting today on the traditional lands of the Kulin Nation, where sovereignty was never ceded. I pay my respects to their elders, past, present, and emerging, and to the elders of other First Nations people present today. Now, in its seventh year, the Small Press Network's Most Underrated Book Award celebrates independently published titles that deserve extra attention. Past winners include The Cook by Wayne McCauley, A Wrong Turn in the Office of Unmade Lists by Jane Rawson, one of this year's judges, and Living in Hope by the late Frank Byrne. MUBA winners have a history of going on to secure distribution deals and international rights. The 2017 winner, a graphic novel, Invisible War, A Tale on Two Scales, went on to sell North American rights after they won the Most Underrated Book Award. Last year's winner, Living in Hope, received national media coverage, a boost in sales, and a distribution deal with New South Books, with Petalis Press books now stocked in over 40 outlets. Importantly, it also recognises the work of small press publishers in promoting books that may not be considered by their bigger counterparts, books and perspectives that definitely deserve more mainstream recognition. Now, this year I was lucky enough to join Reading's digital marketing manager Jackie Tang and author and MUBA alumni Jane Rawson for one of the most wonderfully frictionless judging panels I have ever had the pleasure to serve on. We were in furious agreement with our choices, and you are about to really get a taste of why this shortlist was chosen. Now, Readings is our bookstore partner for today's event, and you will hear, obviously, from each of the authors today. So once you get super excited about their books, you can run up the back and buy a copy and also get it signed at the end of the event by at least two of our authors. So as I've said, I'll be introducing each of the shortlisted authors, and I'm going to then announce the winner at the end, so stay tuned for that. Our first shortlisted author, Ilka Tamka, is shortlisted for her book Songwoman by Text Publishing. Ilka teaches fiction at RMIT University. Her first novel, Skin, was published in 8 countries and nominated for the Voss Literary Prize and the Aurealis Awards in 2016. Her second novel, and the one that we have nominated, Songwoman, was published in October 2018. Ilka lives on 5 acres in the Macedon Ranges of Victoria. Now, here's an excerpt from the judges' comments. The gripping plot follows the struggle for Anglo-Saxon independence in the face of a technologically advanced imperialist force, inevitably raising questions about the cyclical nature of oppression and those who levy it. Songwoman's marginalised hero, Alia, takes on the sadly still all too relevant issues of cultural identity, racism, and gender inequity, all set against a gripping plot rich in politicking, bloody battles, and, of course, romance. A riveting read with a good dose of historical fancy, Songwoman was a clear favourite. So, without more ado, here's Ilka.
Hello, thank you. Thank you, Mel. Thank you for the shortlisting. Okay. I'm just going to read a little bit from Almost at the End, which is a strange spot to read from, but I don't think it gives away any spoilers. So the epigraph to chapter 12 is... chapter 12 is called Poetic Land, and the epigraph is, "The warriors determine the fate of our tribes, but it is the poets who make us immortal." Actually, I'll just give a little context before I start. This is the part, most of my novel is set in ancient, what we now call Wales. And this is a little part of the story where my protagonist goes to Rome and her experience for the first time of seeing the city of Rome. The sun shone through the barred wooden window, falling in crisp stripes on my bed. This was a different light from the soft haze that Lou cast over the tribe lands. It was stronger, prouder, more aware of itself. This was Apollo, the Roman sun. Despite the brightness, I shivered under the thin woolen blanket. In only 4 weeks here, the warmth of late autumn had been replaced by a sharp chill. I rolled onto my side and gazed at my now familiar lodgings. The tiny white-walled room was furnished only with a narrow bed and a boxwood table, upon which stood a water jug and a scattering of silver armbands I had carried with me from Albion. An alcove in the wall above the table sheltered a rough plaster statue of the emperor, but otherwise there was no decoration. It was a rare private room in one of the thousands of cheap inns that lined the Tiber in the northwest quarter of Rome, a room in which Caradog's wife could easily pass herself as just another in the stream of foreign travellers, labourers and traders who journeyed in and out of Rome, seeking their own small slice of its glut. Its lockable door was my room's only testament to the weight of coins I bore in my pouch. I sat up and peered through the bars to the street beyond. The horse-drawn goods carts that rumbled through the night while roads were empty enough to allow their passage were being replaced by the throng of foot traffic and food sellers already shouting their trade. The nutty smell of frying wheat cakes drifting under my doorway told me that the inn's owner had awoken. The day was beginning like every other I had passed within the walls of this city, yet today was not like any other. Today, Caradog, Yvrain, and all the captured chiefs of Albion would be marched in chains around the stone square of the Castra Pretoria, the largest parade ground in Rome. Today, Caradog would face judgment before the Emperor Claudius, a performance purposed only for the amusement of the crowds and the glorification of the empire, for the war king's execution was certain. Today, I would see him for the last time. Along with Yvrain and their children, he had been held under close guard within one of the senator's houses. I had not been permitted to see him. He did not even know that I was here. I poured a glass of water and drained it in one thirsty draught. Rome's water was never cold and tasted of the leaden pipes that carried it into the city. I had left for Rome only hours after Caradog had been dragged in leg rings across Cartamandua's floor. She had grasped my arm once we were alone, pressed coins into my hand and whispered, "There is a horse at the gate. I will give you this night to escape. Then I must be seen to hunt you. Be sure you evade me." I had ridden 9 days to the southeastern tribe lands, sleeping only a few hours each night in the shelter of forests. At the port of Dubris, I gained admission to a Roman trade ship by merchants who did not wonder at a woman travelling alone, so long as she had sufficient silver with which to quiet them. Thus I left the shores of my homeland. I had travelled with a poor woman's invisibility and a rich woman's purse. Both had been needed. In the port markets of Benonia, I had bought a hardy-looking donkey and had proceeded by means firstly of farmhouses and then later inns through the busy roads of Gaul and onward to the empire's first city. I had arrived here in the last moon of autumn. I would leave tomorrow when I had sung my husband's rites. I pulled on a woolen tunic and cloak, tied my sandals and unfastened my door. The price of my room included a meagre breakfast, but I had grown to prefer the noisy hive of food stalls and taverns, the Thermopylae, that lined the river around the corner from my inn. I greeted the housewoman as I passed through the kitchen, then stepped onto the street. Immediately, I was hit by the stench of people in numbers of thousands of thousands. There were no words in my language to express this number, for we had never had cause to fathom it. Only the Roman language could count numbers without end. I turned northward on the narrow street, weaving to navigate the outspilling of wares from the potters, fruit sellers, cloth merchants and candle stores. A bakery and flower stall brimming with roses and oleanders offered respite from the reek of rotting food. Every handspan of this city was sealed by the armour of human life. Houses so densely built you could not walk between them. Paths paved with flagstones as wide as a bull's rump and the immense columned monuments, arches and temples that filled the forum. Nowhere, no time did this land breathe. Robbed of their porousness, the streets stank of human waste. I had wanted to hate it, and yet I did not. It had taken me without question. It did not care that my skin was pale, that my Latin was accented, that I had slain many soldiers of its army. It welcomed any who wished to walk upon it. In only 1 month, I had grown used to what shocked me at first. Rome was a wildness of its own kind. Gone was the steady rhythm of cattle, birdsong, the daily pouring of milk on the earth. This city ran to the drums of trade, the frenzied music of commerce. The hum of the land had been silenced by a human song. It would not last. It could not. It was an illusion, a trance as dazzling and brilliantly fleeting as the fires of summer's eve. And yet whole countries had been enslaved in honour of its growth.
Thank you, Elka. That was very illustrative of things that may be of more modern nature. Our next shortlistee is James Christina for his book Antidote to a Curse, published by Transit Lounge. Born in Malta, James's parents migrated to Australia in the late 60s and he grew up in Melbourne. He has taught English in Australia, Malta, England, the US, Jordan, Bahrain, Switzerland, Belgium, South Korea and Oman. He holds a PhD in creative writing from the University of East Anglia. Here's a bit of what the judges had to say about his book, Antidote to a Curse. Blending the Bosnian War and impending AIDS diagnosis, life in 1990s inner Melbourne, giant aviaries and talking cats, it's hard to find any sense of stability or often to know what it is you are reading as Christina's narrative shifts and changes under you. But that queasy, feverish feeling of moving ground is what makes this story so rewarding. An exciting new voice and a quietly ambitious book that resurrects the philosophical spectres of desire and trauma, displacement and longing, the curse and the antidote. Please welcome James Christina.
Good evening. Thank you. Thank you, Mel, for the introduction, and thank you, Mel, and the judges for the shortlisting. I particularly would like to thank Barry and Tess at Transit for all their support. Okay, I'm going to read two sections tonight that I hope will give you a little bit of a taste of this narrative that does seem to shift around. Okay, the first part that I'll read is Silvio boarding at Nancy. Silvio is 29 years old and Nancy is upward of 80. Back home, Nancy was in her gazebo, aiming her small blue rubber Taxco binoculars at the rafters. She was wearing a lime tracksuit that clashed boldly with her rose plush slippers, although the effect was muted by the frosted glass. The new concrete path had been laid with a fine splash of glitter. Nancy got up, flicked the light bulb off. Ah, then whirled the gold disc of her kerosene lamp. The light of the kerosene splintered the darkness and the glass gazebo itself became a lamp. I was lucky to find a room to let in a house like this. For the first couple of weeks, I kept mostly to myself and kept myself mostly to my room. But Nancy was so accommodating that the division between room and house soon evaporated. I tapped the frosted glass and the door opened. Her black cat, Ludovico, was purring at the foot of the white headless bear rug. She gestured towards the mat, but I stood marvelling at Henry's handiwork. "What are you doing?" I asked. "Igor," she said mischievously, pointing to the bird. "I studied its fractured trajectory. Crimson. Find them up north. Broom," she explained, making eye contact through her reading glasses. For some convoluted reason, the path to Broom seemed further and more disjointed than the route to Bosnia-Herzegovina. "Broom? Must belong to one of the neighbours," she mused. "How did it end up here?" "Henry caught it." "Caught it?" The intonation of my voice rose knowingly. "I think I'll keep it for a while," she admitted with a giggle. "Do you need the binoculars?" I asked. She tilted in her rocking chair but didn't say a word. The furnishing seemed more like Nancy's touch, a lamp table that was covered in lace and beside it a bronze statue of Atlas weighed by a large azure stone. On her lap, I noticed an open book. She was reading the one she had borrowed, Sir Thomas More's Utopia. Lodovico purred resoundingly in his sleep. Nancy and Henry had taken it upon themselves to unpack the rest of my books. She placed them in the study downstairs, four shelves of a wall-length bookcase dedicated to my collection. They had saved me the trouble and expense of buying my own bookcase. I rearranged the books so that they were grouped according to genre rather than size. "How's your stay in Melbourne treating you, Silvio?" I failed to answer. The branches stirred through the clear glass of the door behind her. She pulled the binoculars away. Her brow arched into a V, and for a second she reminded me of Zlatko. "I need a good night's sleep," I said, kneeling on the rug between her and Ludovico. "Here, have this." She poured the remainder of the wine into her long-stemmed glass and passed it to me. "Wolf Blass," I took a swallow. "How's Utopia going?" "Intriguing." I could feel the mellowing effects of the day as I rested on my elbow. "And the bird watching?" "An old passion," she offered. She raised an imaginary glass. "You'll sleep like a cat." I sank into the rug, but Ludovico rose to all fours, turning his green eyes towards me, rubbing his coat to and fro against the back of my hand. Viewing the world side on through the lamplight splinter that illuminated our glass sphere, I sank deeper. Nancy retrieved her wine glass, keen to return to her book. The next section begins with the image of two parallel mirrors, a recurring image in the book. In this short scene that I'm going to read, Silvio anticipates Zlatko's call. Zlatko's story is set in Bosnia, and Silvio's use of it provides the parallel narrative explored in Antidote to a Curse. Zlatko's friendship and story provide Silvio with some scope for escapism, some route apart from the situation of contemplated contingencies and dates relating to his HIV status, or if you like, some escape from the metaphorical fishhook referred to in this scene. I was nudging infinity between the illusory expanses of two mirrors when the phone rang. I put the hand mirror down and the hallway failed. The reflection I faced looked hesitant and a little annoyed. I held Henry's handkerchief to my nose and detected a fragrant scent. Mischief. I burrowed my face into the fine weave and dashed down the wooden staircase, eager to catch the call. A woman responded. It had to be a mistake. "Is that Silvio?" I felt the fishhook dangle between us, and I knew that a single yes would amount to a fatal bite. "He's not here at the moment," I replied. "Oh, could I ask what it's about?" She gave some details. "We'd like to set up an appointment. Could you ask him to call us back?" The voice was hushed and full of cautionary concern. "Will do." I flicked through the pages of my burgeoning journal, full of newspaper cuttings and notes relating to Zlatko's stories. It was possible to be tested in the 10th week and be in possession of a reading that was 95% accurate. The start and end dates were indisputable and highlighted in bold. The window period ended on the 30th, my birthday. The coincidence, if it was a coincidence, was unsettling. For this reason, I set the parameters for a double date, therefore creating a parallel narrative. I fiddled with time in the hope of altering the outcome, but narratives have their own way of working out. There was so much you could do. You planned, you thought, you planned some more, but the ending was something you inherited, something you waited for. Coffee. The number of tiny mirror fragments that made up stalactites spinning disco ball was probably less than the number of fragmented conversations Letko and I held in that restaurant. One tile for each conversation measured out in the duration of a coffee. At night, whenever the door was open, the ball would spin in the slightest breeze. It seemed to tempt the faintest degree of light, refracted and reflected on the brick walls spinning around us. My coffees with Zlatko were often the highlight of my day. Despite the fact that it was located on Lonsdale Street, with floor-to-ceiling sheets of plate glass, the cafe felt a world apart. What was that book you recommended? Bihać, next to the Croatian border? That's it. He pulled out the book from his rucksack. On the cover was a shield. The shield was decorated with traditional fleur-de-lis, yellow fleur-de-lis arranged on a blue field and divided by a white band. It was not the first time I had seen the flag of Bosnia-Herzegovina. I had seen the heraldic shield on the news footage. For some reason, I found the image both memorable and striking. Is this linked to your story? Thank you.
Thank you, James. It's quite enjoyable to read a book that also name checks local areas just a block from here. So kind of harkening back to that era of the 90s in, you know, within a very short sort of space from where we are today. So that brings us up to our third and final shortlistee for this award, Sue McPherson, for her book Brontide, published by Magabala Books. Sue is a visual artist living in Yumundi, Queensland. She was born in Sydney to an Aboriginal mother from Wiradjuri country. Sue was adopted into the McPherson family, landowners from the Batlow area in New South Wales, when she was very young. A weekend writing workshop inspired Sue to join a writer's group and commit to writing a young adult novel, Grace Beside Me, which won the Cruel Dagan Indigenous Writing Competition through the State Library of Queensland, which, you know, having had her as a shortlistee here today is a strong indication that creative writing programs obviously work. Here's some of what the judges had to say about Brontide. Despite its brevity, these pages hold a deceptively ambitious structure, told via interviews with four high school boys in a small Queensland town. These four voices ring out with irreverence, humour, pain and longing. Their thoughts are presented unvarnished, resulting in big moments that are in turn hilarious, confronting and even heartbreaking. Utterly unpretentious, this is a hidden gem that would particularly appeal to reluctant teen or even adult readers who still want complex and nuanced storytelling. The book is not without flaws, but the reader is quickly swept up in a compelling narrative and few will leave dry-eyed. Sue unfortunately can't be here today, so reading for her is Lenka Vanderboom, a Kimberley girl and director of Magabala Books Indigenous Publishing House. Please welcome Lenka to the stage.
Hi, everybody. It's a pleasure to be here on behalf of Sue McPherson and on behalf of Magabala Books. So thank you for having me. I am from Broome. So before I read an extract, I'd like to give you a bit of context, and maybe there'll be a bit of crossover with what Mel said. But about Brontide, it is written in an interview format, and Sue wrote it specifically for reluctant teen readers. She says she was a reluctant teen reader herself at school, so she wanted to write a really good yarn that was short, but that gave you something afterwards, something to think about. She says reluctant readers don't want to read something that's been dumbed down. They want to absorb, they want to learn, and they want to achieve. They just don't want to read sometimes a lot of words on a page. To set the scene, the main characters in the book are four teenage boys and their interviewer, Sue, who's doing a storytelling project in a school. There's Rob and his brother Penn, who are white Aussies. Rob is 17 and believes real men take risks. He has an overbearing and racist father. Penn, who's Rob's brother, is 15. He's a storyteller, a graffiti artist who everybody likes, and he's mates with Benny Boy. Benny Boy's 12. He's Aboriginal. He loves drawing, fishing, and living with his awesome foster nan. Benny Boy has an epilepsy. And although Rob, who doesn't know this, has witnessed a fit, he judges Benny Boy and assumes he's a bit of a drinker. Benny Boy doesn't trust Rob, his older brother, Penn's older brother. Jack's 17. He's a white kid from the bush, adopted into an Aboriginal family, and he's new to town. Now I'm going to read a little of the interview between Sue and Benny Boy. Wednesday, 10 a.m., St. Nicholas Lutheran College, Tarraloon, room 5A. Sue, what's your name? Benny Boy. Mum called me Benny. Nice to meet you. Benny Boy, my name's Sue. Yep. So what's your story, Benny Boy? Dunno, got no story. Everybody's got a story. I was told you love fishing. Love fish, love flatheads. They're good fighting fish and good to look at. Love snapper. Yeah, they're good to look at. But I don't catch them, only if I'm real hungry. I just like looking at them, swimming and... Oh, I love cooking and eating with my nan. Is that who you live with? Yeah, I live with Nan. And Ramsay, and Narry Bird. Who's Ramsay? Our dog. He's got three legs, and he's got 1.5 ears. And he's got a crooked bark. A crooked bark? What do you mean? Well, you know, like he doesn't know if he's a pup or if he's a grown-up dog. Nan says it's not as strong and straight up like a normal bark. It's crooked. How about Narry Bird? Oh, Narry Bird faints all the time. He'll be swinging, he'll be talking up. Real neat one, real good one. Next minute, on his toes, in the air. 5 minutes later, he's back on the swing again. He's Narry. He's got a few problems then. Poor old Narry Bird. Tell us about Nan. Ah, Nan. She's pissed off. I ripped one of my new shirts for school. Now she's got the new know-whats. What's she like? Is she funny? She's fat. You mean chubby? No, I mean she's fat. Okay. And she's white. She tells deadly jokes. She learns me to read books and be a good cook. She likes to sing with the radio and she loves good manners. And Kylie Kwong's cooking and hot chips and brown vinegar. She doesn't like wearing shoes. Only when we go shopping. She fills me Coke bottle up with cortigal and juice. Or, you know, not allowed to have that Coke. Rots your teeth and your insides. I like my insides. And she has a beer every afternoon at 4:30. And her nose holes, they go real wide when there's a storm or new rain coming. It's the Brontide. And that's all I'm giving you tonight, because this light and brave book is actually so gripping, and there's just too many spoilers to read anymore. So I do have a letter, though, from Sue and the Brontide boys for you tonight. So are you ready for that? this is their letter. G'day. Good on you, Miss Lenka, for reading this out, and apologies for not being there. A big shout out to Miss Ilka and Text, and also Mr. James and Transit Lounge, us Brontide boys, and Nick, the dog. Reckon you're bloody amazing storytellers. We know we're in real good company. As storytellers, we also know how hard it is to write your character's truth. When we were writing Brontide, Sue, she fired us around for months, too scared to say what we wanted. We didn't even like each other for a bit. And a few of us, we were even keen to find another author. Eventually she got her shits together and here we are. Being brave and saying what's real, it's not easy. Being brave to publish what's real is probably just as hard. Anyways, thanks to all our readers. You know our stories. You know there's more to us. Sue's busy round with other characters in a new yarn now, but she sends her biggest and her best wishes to everyone in the room. We're underrated and we're finalists and we're ucking proud as. That's ucking without the F. Thanks for listening. Rob, Penn, Benny Boy, Jack, Nig, Muggabulla Mob. Thank you.
Lenka, thank you. That was amazing. Honestly, this is one of the most difficult parts of today. As you've heard, like, all three of these books were just real standouts. Honestly, it was just the most amazing judging process, because we all loved these books. We really, you know, thought about the shortlist as we put it together, and have really tried to express that in the judges' comments. You yourselves have heard a lot tonight, and I cannot commend these books highly enough in terms of, you know, just encouraging you to get out there and buy them. And I do have to say, Brontide made pretty much all of us cry. That is a recommendation, by the way, as well. So now is the moment that you have all been waiting for. The winner of the 2019 Most Underrated Book Award is Ilka Tamka for Songwoman. Congratulations, Ilka. And please congratulate all of the other shortlistees as well. But I'd like to welcome Ilka to the stage now to accept her award.
Oh, so I really want to, especially having heard you both read, I really want to thank the Small Press Network, firstly, as a reader, for bringing good books to my attention. Not just my fellow shortlistees who I've read and second the commendation to you, but also to the previous winners of the MUBA, such as Jane Rawson and Wayne McCauley, who Mel mentioned, whose work I'm also a really big fan of. So thank you, Small Press Network, as a reader. But as a writer, this recognition means a lot to me. Writing a book isn't easy. At least this one wasn't for me. It took 2.5 years, and it pretty much deployed every bit of creative and intellectual energy that I had. There were several times, particularly towards the end of the writing process, when I was working 12-hour days at my desk, There were several times in that period that I felt totally beaten by this. I felt that I could not give so much of myself to the act of writing when there were dogs to be walked, friends to be maintained, children to be loved. I was mentally and physically exhausted. And then it was done. I flew to Bali with my daughter for a women's retreat and began the process of putting myself back together again. Penny, my editor at Text Publishing, rang me with those very brief yet beautiful words that every writer longs to hear when they've submitted a new manuscript, which in her case is, "I've read your manuscript, it's good. We don't need much." I think I speak for most writers when I say that we don't pour this kind of energy into our work for recognition. We don't do it for success or for sales, God forbid. We do it because there is an idea that grips our imagination and our hearts so deeply that we are compelled to explore it and to live it and to find a shape for it in narrative and in metaphor and in language. We do it because it's such an incredible buzz to find that beautiful, expressive sentence that does exactly what you want it to do, and to see the great muscle slabs of a novel cohering into a fully formed body. And we do it because we hope that once our creative business with that idea has come to an end and the book is finished, we hope that the idea will continue in the imagination of the readers, and that it might take its small place in the wider cultural conversation. So when Song Woman was published last year and failed to make a splash, it was not the blow to my ego that I regretted, although writers do have very fragile egos, but the ending of the life of an idea, the ending of a conversation about that idea. And that's why the MUBA is such a lovely award and such a sweet honour, because it comes when a writer thinks that their book has missed its chance. It's an acknowledgement that says, we think your ideas are interesting and worth reading about. It's a voice back in that cultural conversation. And there's nothing more galvanising and heartening for a writer to hear than that voice back. So I really want to thank the Small Press Network for running the award. I think it's deeply encouraging to writers, and I think that's really positive for Australia's cultural life. I want to thank the judges for their hard work in reading and discussing the works and selecting the three shortlisted authors. I want to thank my publishers, Text Publishing, for getting behind the book and for putting it forward for this award. And lastly, I really do feel that I have to thank my publicist, Jane Watkins, because I know she felt incredibly guilty when I was nominated for this award, because she felt like she hadn't done a great job, which she really, really had. So thank you very much.
I just want to again thank all of today's shortlisted authors and also obviously readers. So if you could give them all a huge hand. It's really no small thing, I guess, to write a book and put it out there and then feel as though it hasn't reached your audience. Absolutely no shade on the amazing work that publishers do, but anything that we can do to help lift up books that deserve it is a part of what that is. So please give everyone a huge hand.
Thanks for listening to the Wheeler Centre podcast. Don't forget to visit wheelercentre.com for the best in books, writing and ideas from Melbourne, Australia and the world.